reasons set forth in the briefs. If it pleases the court, I'll start with the erroneous instruction on the mens rea element, reckless disregard. The Supreme Court has made clear that generic criminal recklessness requires two essential components.
Okay, so say I agree with you that this instruction was erroneous, but I'm struggling with harmlessness. So it seems to me that the way the instruction was given, in order for the jury to convict, it had to think that she understood the facts that created the risk. If that's true, it would seem to me that the jury found that your client understood the facts when she saw the ID. And if that's true, then I don't understand how the difference in the instructions that you're arguing about have anything to do with what the jury found or why it would make a difference.
Yes, Your Honor. Under the correct definition of criminal recklessness, she has to not only know the facts or see the car, but she has to draw the inference from the facts that there's a substantial or unjustifiable risk. And under the circumstances of the case, particularly given her severe vision disability.
But the vision disability, I don't know that you can go to, because if the jury thought she knew the facts, that means she saw the card, I think. That's the seeing the card is what sort of highlights the risk, isn't it?
Well, I do want to address that, but first of all, the government hasn't argued harmlessness, so they've waived it and conceded it.
I agree that I'll ask them about that, but we don't have to have a whole trial again just because they made a mistake, right? We can reach harmlessness on our own.
Well, Your Honor, this is a very high burden, even if they had argued harmlessness, because seeing the card is not the same as processing the information on the card. What she had to be able to do is process subtle differences in the facial features of Mr. Martinez and the person on the card. Yeah, she looked at the card, but with her vision disabilities, and frankly, anybody who just looks at it, those two people look a lot alike, particularly given the fact that
I jury find that she knew the facts that created the risk. And so doesn't that mean that she saw, I mean, I think the jury had to have thought that she saw that this didn't look like him. And at that point, it's hard to understand how she wouldn't have had the inference of he's probably not this person. And he probably doesn't have real documentation. I mean, it's hard to see how if you really saw this, which I think the jury found, that you would then not have the inference.
Well, Your Honor, you have to consciously disregard it. She testified that she looked at it quickly. And, you know, at a glance, I think they look a lot alike.
But how can the jury believe that and still convict under the instruction they were given?
Because the instruction said, if those facts are considered and weighed in a reasonable manner.
Not those facts. Knowledge.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a difference between facts and knowledge. Knowledge connotes understanding of the facts.
That's the point of the instruction the jury convicted under. Did talk about knowledge of the facts, and I think if you have knowledge of these facts, I don't know how anyone doesn't draw the inference. I mean, it seems like you're at that point you need to rely on the idea that you would have knowledge that this isn't his ID, and yet not worry that he is trying to sneak in the country without valid documentation. And that inference seems so obvious that I don't know how you have how there's not a harmless error here.
Well, Your Honor, I believe knowledge just means awareness. It doesn't mean, you know, you see the card. It means that you know what's on the card.
She knew what was on the card, and she knew this wasn't him.
Well, Your Honor, I don't agree with that, because I think that there are substantial similarities between these people. Mr. Martinez testified that some of the agents thought it was him. So just seeing the card and knowing that, you know, here's a young man that has brown hair and, you know, the picture's kind of dark in the valid border crossing card, I do not think that leads to an awareness of a substantial and unjustifiable risk and a conscious disregard of that risk. Because as Farmer says, you not only have to know the facts, you have to draw the inference of the facts. And people are not always aware of, they don't always know things that reasonable people know.
I mean, the jury here must have found that he knew. People can always know.
Well, no, what they were instructed was that they could convict if she merely failed to consider and weigh the facts that she knew in a reasonable manner.
But first they had to find that she knew the facts that facts that created the risk. And I don't know how to interpret that other than that they thought she knew that this ID didn't match this person.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think what that means is that she knew what was on the card. She knew the two pictures on the card. But another problem with
this. Doesn't that not create the risk then? I mean, you're taking away part of the instruction. She had to know the facts that created the risk. And seeing the card sounds like you're only giving her part of the knowledge. It seems like the facts that created the risk are the card doesn't match this guy.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the instruction clearly conveys that. I mean, Farmer also says that recklessness is a very tricky concept for jurors because it is so easily confused with negligence. And actually, in civil context, in tort context, it's a different definition. And so really, the correct instruction, the instruction requested by counsel, aware of and consciously disregards the stamps of a substantial and unjustifiable risk, is what was needed here. And another problem with the court's instruction is that it was an objective standard, not a subjective standard. So the jury could have easily just, you know, said, well, I would know that. A reasonable person would know that without even considering her vision disabilities. And another reason it's not harmless, Your Honor, is that the government repeatedly in closing argument said, that wasn't reasonable of her. I mean, what would a reasonable person have done? So the government was inviting the jury to use a reasonableness standard.
I happen to agree that you have a very good argument about this instruction. I just don't see how your argument about why the instruction is erroneous maps onto anything that matches with what the jury could have found. So, but I don't want to take all your time. I know you have other issues.
But, you know, reasons it's not harmless, they look a lot alike. Mr. Martinez, in fact, testified he didn't think she knew. There were a defense alien smuggling expert who said that this really wasn't consistent with alien smuggling. There were reasons to doubt the officers, and really the jury's emphasis in closing argument for all of those reasons. And, well, and another reason, too, is that under Vander, what the court has to consider is whether a jury rationally could have reached a contrary finding, and that is a very, very high standard. And here we know that this jury was grappling with this issue with the wrong instruction. If they had the right instruction, they would have been grappling with it even more, I contend. Are there any further questions on that issue? I'll move to the second issue. Confrontation. The government did not meet its burden to demonstrate unavailability of Mr. Martinez. They did not even attempt to contact him on the address that they had for him on his card.
Could they have done that from that they knew he had a lawyer?
Well, it was their burden. It wasn't their lawyer, his lawyer's burden to contact him, but they needed to give the address.
Do you ethically contact someone who has a lawyer?
Well, assuming that you need to contact the lawyer made clear well before the trial at issue in this case that he didn't have the address. He said, I believe that's on ER page 195, I don't have the address. I never get an address. At that point, the government definitely had the burden to give him the address and allow him to try to contact. Didn't do that. They have to be both diligent and competent, and they weren't here.
And they could have asked the defense lawyer for permission to make the contact directly.
Oh, yes, sir.
Just because he's represented doesn't mean the lawyer can't say, well, by all means, for the limited purpose of seeking his appearance at trial, you can contact him.
Yes, and if he agrees to come, if you reach him, then he can be represented by the attorney.
The defendant's waivers of privilege wasn't by the client, but the lawyer. This is a new proposition to me.
Your Honor, I have to admit, it's not something I looked closely.
You very quickly agreed with Judge Bennett, but maybe it was time.
Well, Your Honor, possibly so.
So recently, came to you and said, can I contact your client? I don't mean this client, just your hypothetical client. Would you be authorized to say, yes, go ahead and do it? I'm not sure you would.
Well,
I think you do that.
Actually,
the client could do it.
Actually, I think the representation was over at that point unless he came back to appear at trial.
That's a different question.
That's a different question.
That's a different question altogether.
But
I'm sure that's a different answer. And maybe that's a good answer to Judge Freeland's question. The representation is over, and so there was no ethical bar, but I don't know.
Well, Your Honor, I think the whole thing is beside the point because the government easily could have given the address to the attorney once they found out that the attorney did not have an address.
The district court, I think, found that reasonable efforts were made. Is that something we review for clear error or de novo? What is our standard of review? What kind of question is this?
It's a constitutional question. It's a confrontation question, and it's reviewed de novo. And I would say that,
is that a fact-finding, though, that's part of the confrontation question?
Well, under this court's precedent, it's per se unreasonable not to attempt to contact. And that was never, the district court never considered that fact, that they had an address.
The district court seems to have thought they did. You just said per se unreasonable not to attempt to contact, but I think the district court thought they did attempt to contact. They contacted the lawyer. And, we may disagree with the district court about whether reasonable efforts were made here, but I'm trying to figure out how we say that, what we have to say about what the district court thought.
Well, it's per se unreasonable not to try to contact when you have an address.
Well, not if he's represented or evident. I don't know. They just make a blanket statement like that. That seems not to be true as a blanket statement, so it has to be more nuanced, right?
Well, the district court did not consider the fact that they had an address on the card and that they didn't give it to the defense attorney or try to contact. That's something that just wasn't discussed. It wasn't the defendant's burden to bring that up. It was the government's burden to demonstrate unavailability.
And so what did the government actually do?
All the government did is they sent a letter to the material witness's attorney to the material witness care of the attorney at an address in Tucson and said, we'll pay for your expenses and we'll parole you in. That's all they did. They didn't ask the attorney if he had an address for him. They didn't do anything else. And then I think they checked to see whether Mr. Martinez had entered the country again. But that's all they did. Are there any further questions on that? I know I wanted to reserve time, but
you talked about, so he was cross-examined in a deposition earlier, right?
Yes, he was.
And was the cross-examination shown to the jury?
It was.
So do we have any indication of what further would have been asked or how it would have been different if he actually had attended the trial?
Your Honor, that is not part of the harmlessness analysis. You just have to consider the testimony that was admitted at trial through the video deposition because if the government doesn't meet its burden to demonstrate unavailability, that shouldn't have come in. But the Supreme Court has made clear that live testimony is far preferable, even when you have a video deposition, especially in this video deposition. You can't see who the witness is looking at, whether he's making eye contact with the defendant. This trial happened over a year after the video deposition. There was a lot of investigation and expert work that was done that he couldn't be cross-examined on. So it was definitely harmful error. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Again, I'm still Bob Ritzkoff from the United States Attorney's Office in Tucson. The court's jury instruction on reckless disregard was inadequate in this case. The court's instruction was consistent with instructions by the 10th and 11th Circuit on this specific issue regarding what reckless disregard means.
Well, it's something the 10th Circuit decision was decided 2 years before the Supreme Court decided Farmer.
Yes, but it's still...
Do you think that makes any difference?
I'm not convinced that recklessness in general is the same as reckless disregard, actually. I think the fact that you've got the disregard in there is something that I think makes it a different animal than just simply recklessness. But in any event, the instruction the court gave was not inconsistent with any Ninth Circuit case regarding reckless disregard. And in fact, was similar to commentary in the Ninth Circuit model jury instructions. So considering all those.
Our model jury instructions could be outdated, though, right?
That is correct. The court has found that they are not binding statements of the law. But, and also, the government's position is, on this issue, we're on plain error review because the defendant did not make the argument to the trial court that he's making here, the specific argument he's making here. So, especially.
Can you explain how you think the instruction is consistent with Rodriguez and Farmer?
Because the way the court changed it, it requires knowledge of facts. And then it says, which if considered in a reasonable, considered in a way in a reasonable manner, indicated substantial and an unjustifiable risk that the alien was there.
Of which he is aware, though, right? I think you're skipping relevant words.
I think the knowledge of facts phrase encompasses that.
I mean, what's the difference with negligence, then?
Negligence is basically should have known. Should have been acting reasonably.
You or should have known, right? So, I mean, I thought the difference was that in recklessness, you have to be aware of the risk and yet disregard it. And you're skipping the words, our cases of which he is aware when you quote. So, I mean, we say the risk of which he is aware, so I'm not sure how this jury instruction is consistent with that.
Again, like I said, I'm not sure. One of the problems that when you look at this in trying to incorporate cases discussing reckless as opposed to reckless disregard, the cases, not jury cases discussing recklessness, talk about it being a conscious disregard. I don't see how conscious disregard, you can square that with reckless disregard, which is what the statute uses in this case.
Why not?
Because I think they're different concepts. Recklessly disregarding something is different from consciously disregarding something would be. I would say, I don't see you're recklessly consciously disregarding something, you're consciously recklessly disregarding something. I'm not sure when Congress is using the term reckless disregard, it is incorporating the generic reckless mens rea.
Doesn't the reckless include conscious?
say we disagree with you about that, too. Why didn't you talk about harmlessness? Because we're in a little bit of a tough spot now.
You didn't talk about harmlessness. We have to review it as a plain error case where the defendant would have the burden to demonstrate that there was prejudice.
But say we read her objections as adequate to preserve this issue and not a plain error standard. What should we do about the fact that you didn't argue harmlessness here?
Well, yeah, as you noted, you can still consider it even though we didn't do it, even though we didn't argue it. And again,
should we do trial here?
You should, because in fairness to the district judge, what the district judge did in this case was realize there was no controlling law in this circuit, looked at the court's moral jury searches, which I agree are not binding, but they also cited two other circuits that gave basically the same definition in this specific context. I don't see how you can, with those set of facts, you can say the judge abused his discretion in giving that instruction.
Well, if it's legally wrong, then we have to, unless it's harmless. So, do you have an argument that it's harmless?
Yes, I think if you look at the facts of this case, and the fact that the instruction required the jury to find knowledge of the facts, that means the jury had to have determined that the defendant knew that it wasn't his ID, which means that she was acting in reckless disregard.
I'm a little bit confused. Are you saying the instruction that was given complies with Farmer, or are you saying that Farmer doesn't apply to the instruction in this case?
I am going back to the argument, which apparently is not making much headway, that reckless disregard is different than simply recklessness. I mean, I think you've got to look at it in the context of what how the statute
is. But the Ninth Circuit is applying Farmer a prior reckless disregard case. It happens to be named Rodriguez, not the defendant in this case, but a prior case, so I think that's a losing argument. Are you familiar with that Rodriguez case?
No, I don't have to talk about
it. I suspect if you were, you wouldn't be making your argument.
But in any event, the facts of this case were such that the instruction that was given by the court did not prejudice the defendant under the specific facts of this case, which were in addition to the conclusion that she must have known that the ID was not his. You've got the fact that she picks up somebody who she doesn't know, she's never met before. The interactions that occurred at the checkpoint, where she was trying to essentially shield the alien from the questioning by the Border Patrol agents. You wear that all together, there was very compelling evidence of guilt in this case. So in that regard, any error in the instruction was harmless. So on the issue of the unavailable witness, the issue in this case is whether what the government did was reasonable, not whether it was perfect, not whether the government could have done more, whether it's reasonable. And trying to contact a witness through their attorney is reasonable.
But the attorney says, look, I don't have anyone I've contacted. Obviously, why is the attorney so important for the government to do that?
I'm not sure the government had an adequate interest in the defendant. As I know, I would say the evidence is not sure the government had an adequate interest in the defendant. The only interest on the card that was introduced at trial was, and I'm going to mispronounce this, I know, so excuse me, Lowe's Melchor Ocampo Gerlesingo Third Cruz, essentially. At his deposition, the alien testified that he lives on a ranch, quote, all by itself, close quote, about an hour away from Melchor Ocampo. So I'm not sure how good that address that we have is actually was an hour away from the
car. Isn't there some address on an ID? Is that the same address you're talking about?
That's the address on the ID. So,
but no one tried to find him at that address, right?
Well, and again, it all comes back to reasonableness. Is it reasonable to rely on contacting the attorney? And
do we have a case that says it is?
I think the closest case is the Matusaya case, and then there's an unpublished case.
Tell us about an unpublished case. What's the Matusaya? Say that again.
Matusaya. I'm sorry.
I was saying for that.
Yeah. It's 655 F3rd 1092.
Is that one of our cases?
Yes. And basically in that case, because the defendant didn't object, there was no record made.
But here the defendant did object.
There was no record made because the defendant didn't object. So on appeal, it was a plain error review. And the court concluded that there wasn't plain error because basically the government could have established that it had attempted to contact the defendant through the attorney by submitting a letter like was done here, basically the same procedure that was used here. They said because of that, there was no plain error. So that supports the argument. If those steps are taken, it's reasonable. And that's what was done here.
What standard of review do you think we use on this question?
Generally, it's a confrontation clause. It's de novo, but I think the factual determinations, you have to look at the clear error.
Are diligence and competence factual questions?
Well, the standard is reasonableness, and I think reasonableness is that is
much reasonableness turns on whether or not the government was diligent and competent in time to procure the witnesses.
Under the facts of that it's confirmed, yes.
I'm just asking you, you said this is factual. I'm just wondering whether those are really facts. I mean, whether somebody's diligent, it's not like one seems like you can, it's not like speeding where you can hold a radar gun and figure out how long to go down into whether somebody's diligent or competent. Those are more like judgments.
They are judgments, but they're also factual judgments based on the factual scenario that the government is confronted with. I mean, we've got to remember that this witness is in a foreign country where the government does not have subpoena power. So what's reasonable in that context may be different from a defendant that's like in another state or something. You've got to look at the factual context to determine what reasonableness is. And in this case, he was represented by an attorney. It was reasonable for the government to attempt to contact him through his attorney. Unless the court has any further questions or those issues. Thank you.
Can you help us give a little time left for a moment?
Couple of points. As Your Honor pointed out, for the recklessness issue, the issue is whether there was knowledge of the risk, not knowledge of facts. And I do contend that the knowledge here was looking at the card and seeing what the card displayed, not recognizing that there were specific differences with the facial features. And this is, first of all, the government's waived harmlessness, conceded it, and under the high standard they would have to meet, they can't, because a rational jury could have reached a contrary conclusion. It's the facts here where we had a juror who wasn't going to convict, and the jury was grappling with these issues, even with incorrect instruction, shows that.
Counsel, have you compared, in Farmer, they say to the model penal code, which then has four subsections.
Yes, sir.
And have you compared the instruction actually given by the district court judge here with the definition of recklessness regarding model penal code?
Yes, Your Honor, and I have it here. And actually, the requested written instruction was based on the model
penal code.
consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk.
Well, I'm talking about the relationship between the actual instruction given and the model penal code.
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, the instruction given is the negligence instruction, which is you should be aware of a substantial and unjustifiable risk and fail to perceive it. So the instruction given was much closer to the negligence model penal code instruction than to the recklessness. And with regard to the confrontation issue, this wasn't addressed. It had the indication S/N, which means there's no number. It is out in the village, and the Mexico post office confirms that that's how people can receive their mail at the post office, which they don't have an address. Pina Gutierrez, the witness has been deported, so the fact that the witness has been deported does not absolve the government of the obligation to try to contact them at the address. It should have been given to the Matwood attorney, and that's the preferred way. And this is de novo review because it requires evaluating the totality of the circumstances to determine whether it's reasonable.
So your opposing counsel pointed us to Matas Zayas, which I'm looking at, and am I right that it actually found that relying on just contacting the lawyer and offering to pay was plain error?
Yes. Well, no, they found that the government didn't demonstrate that to the court, but in Matas Zayas, which is addressed in my reply brief, there was no indication that there was an address for the individual and that the government didn't give the address to the material witness's attorney, so it's a very different situation. And I would also underscore that the district court was not aware that the government had the address.